Members, please take your seats. Turn off or silence all cell phones or electronic devices. Children, Families, and Senior Subcommittee will now come to order. Jude Lean, please call the roll and announce quorum.
Chair Koster.
Here.
Representatives Basabi.
Here.
Bearfield.
Here.
Black.
Here.
Borrero.
Here.
Gossett Seidman.
Here.
Harris.
Here.
Joseph.
Here.
Lopez. Lopez. Maney.
Here.
Michael.
Here.
Placencia.
Here.
Rayner Goolsby.
Here.
Roach.
Present.
Robinson F.
Here.
Tremont.
Here.
Williams.
Here.
And Woodson.
Here.
A quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Julene. Welcome, members. As I forecasted at our last meeting, this meeting we're going to hear presentations by two of our agencies that serve under the subcommittee's jurisdiction to help you become more familiar with the work that they do. After each presentation, there will be time for members' questions, so just hold your questions till the end of each individual presentation. I'll ask that all questions and follow-up questions go through the chair so we can ensure there's time for all members to get their questions asked and answered. Today, we're hearing from the Department of Elder Affairs and the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. At our next meeting, we're going to hear from the other agencies within our jurisdiction. These presentations over the course of our next two meetings are intended to be high-level overviews of the agencies, and I certainly encourage all of the members who want to dive deeper into these issues, either specific to any of these agencies, to please reach out to our presentation, our presenters, who are eager to talk with you and answer any questions or dig into any of these issues that each of you find important. First, we're going to start with Michelle Brannon, Secretary Brannon. She's the Secretary of Department of Elder Affairs. And welcome, Secretary Brannon, you're recognized.
Madam Chair, before she starts, I just have a general question. If we have questions for the presenters, you want us to ask them, personally ask them, or you don't want us to ask them while we're here?
Thank you for your question. Definitely, you're welcome to ask questions. Let's just wait until Secretary Brannon finishes her presentation, and then I'll recognize members for questions.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Maney, Ranking Member Robinson, and committee members for your time today. I'm so excited to be here with you and anxious to really tell you a little bit more about the Department of Elder Affairs and who we serve. We're going to discuss it, as the chair said, at a 30,000-foot overview. The slides are a little bit more detailed. There are printed copies, but if you do have any questions, do feel free to reach out to me or any of our staff members, and we will make sure that you get all of your questions answered. So I like to say that we are a small agency with a big footprint. 28% of our state's population are over the age of 60. But that's no surprise because Florida is such a great place to live, and our population continues to grow thanks to all of our governor's Freedom First policies. There's an estimated 1,000 people moving here every day, and approximately a quarter of those are seniors. The average retiree in Florida contributes just under $3,000 more to the state and local economies than they consume in public services. And that's a little bit about our constituents you see up there on the slide, but a little bit more about our department. The way that I see it, we're really aging together. We're aging every day, and if we're lucky and if we're blessed, we'll age to be elders in living in Florida. So when all the working and the doing and raising families is complete and it's time to rest, we really want to ensure that we're doing everything we can to guarantee the greatest quality of life for our elders living in Florida. Our job is to help older people of Florida live healthy, safe, and independent lives. In essence, we want to ensure that every person is able to age in the place of their choosing, literally for as long as they choose to be there. And our services are meant to do just that. Of course, every agency has a mission and a vision and a major focus. But really, we want to create a better future for Floridians as they age. And that's a lofty implementation, and it's guided by our mission, our vision, and our major focus. We want to improve the well-being of Florida's oldest adults through home and our community-based services. And then I just wanted to share that more than 1.2 million Floridians age 60 and up receive services from the department in the fiscal year 21-2022. So up you'll see on the slide, this is our budget, and it's just a quick snapshot of the budget. The total agency budget is approximately $350 million. That's in the current fiscal year. We're a very service-driven agency, so the majority of our funding goes to support seniors aging at home or in the place of their choosing through our home and community-based services, and you're going to hear that theme echoed throughout this presentation. Home and community-based, trying to have people live well and age well in the place of their choosing. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about those programs later on in the presentation. So let's talk about the Older Americans Act, or the OAA. The Federal Older Americans Act provides assistance in the development of new or improved programs to help older persons by awarding grants to the states for community planning and services. And many allotments of the states are calculated by a statutory formula, and it's based on the population of the state and the historic funding of the state. So that's really how we get our OAA funding each year. And then I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Florida's Aging Network. And if you've been a part of this network, if you have grandparents or parents, you know that this aging network is complex. So the priority over the past year was identifying the gaps and looking for the places that we can make improvements. So part of our journey through the state in this year of evaluation I had as my first year of secretary was really not only to identify gaps in service and how do we close those gaps, but look at the places that we were doing things really well and see if we could scale those things up and out throughout the state. We do this through our 11 area agencies on aging, and they work directly with the providers in the communities. And we'll talk a little bit more about the area agencies on aging throughout the state. The providers that they work with are groups like senior centers, healthcare providers, legal services, and other community type organizations. So that's a little bit about the type of provider that our area agencies on aging work with. So next, we tried to create a pyramid to make things look a little easier for you. You'll see in the infographic. That describes us at the top, the Department of Elder Affairs, and we work closely with our partners, the 11 area agencies on aging that I just mentioned, and they work directly with 49 lead agencies, and then those lead agencies work with direct service providers. But that wouldn't be complete if we didn't look at what the governor did with us in his first 100 days of office. He put together a very aggressive dementia action plan. I'm very proud of the infrastructure we have in Florida. So we have 16 dementia care and cure initiatives across the state, and we have 17 memory disorder clinics. You'll also see 303 congregate meal sites, and I've gotten to visit literally 50 or 60 of these congregate meal sites throughout the year, and they're just incredible. Also, we have an elder helpline, which is housed here at the department, but all 11 area agencies on aging also have their own helplines that dovetail right into our helpline. So you'll see throughout the network a very seamless and one-stop shop approach for that. So here on the map, you're just going to see how we've broken it up really quickly, our 11 planning service areas, and I've visited each one of them throughout the year. So we'll talk a little bit about these planning service areas. One of the things I just wanted to hit on, we talked about congregate meals. Our nutrition services touch a large number of seniors across the state. We annually serve around 30,000 clients through congregate meal sites. And like I said, I visited quite a few of them. And then another 30,000 through home-delivered meals. This was ever more prevalent and critical. So I think we served several thousand more post-hurricane. So we delivered shelf-stable meals and hot meals to those people that were highly impacted and displaced by the hurricane. So thousands more meals came after the impact of Hurricane Ian. And then just to touch a little bit more about the aging network, the Older Americans Act funds allows the AAAs to conduct disease prevention and health promotion services, elder abuse, neglect, and exploitation and outreach, and also provides a tremendous amount of support to family caregivers and their extended families. And I'm proud to tell you about the long-term care ombudsman program. We have a new state ombudsman, and we're renovating this program because after COVID and the post-COVID world, we really wanted to make sure that these ombudsmen were out there in communities. There are 4,000 long-term care communities throughout the state of Florida, so a lot of places to visit. They are a volunteer-based program, and they have over 200 of these volunteers right now. They investigate complaints concerning the health, safety, and welfare or rights of residents in all of these long-term care communities. And they work with the residents and the families to provide resolution. They also work with our sister agency, ACCA, who is the regulatory agency for the long-term care communities. So they really are an advocacy group, and they work directly with the patients and the families. The program, like I said, has over 200 volunteers, and we're actively recruiting more. So if anybody would like to be an ombudsman, you let me know. And a little bit about our Medicaid programs. The department has two primary roles when it comes to Medicaid, so I'm going to briefly touch on those roles. First, we have the Comprehensive Assessment and Review for Long-Term Care Services, and that is a mouthful, but we refer to that as our CARES team. And our CARES team was even more critical post-hurricane as we deployed them out into the impacted areas, and they did assessments in the shelters, so it was incredible to see our CARES teams working. They screen seniors who are seeking Medicaid assistance for nursing facilities or our community and home-based services. They do face-to-face, which I think is vital and critical to really sit down with the residents and ensure that we get the proper screening and those residents get directly to the resources and services they need. The care staff, like I said, was highly engaged after Hurricane Ian and really presented one of the most critical things that our department could provide. So they established sustainable and living accommodations for those folks that lived in the shelters. And I visited our special needs shelters, was deployed many times to Fort Myers and then to other impacted areas in Osceola, and I can't tell you how important and critical it was to find folks sustainable homes and get them, even though the shelters were doing an incredibly good job, but to get them to the next most sustainable housing experience. So very grateful to our CARES team. We also have a statewide Medicaid Managed Care Long-Term Care Program. Again, another mouthful. The second role here is this program is administered specifically by ACCA, but our area agencies on aging, the partners that I just told you about, do the enrollment for those persons. So we've enrolled 120,000 clients in this program. And you see a little bit about what this program offers. You have caregiver training, respite care, attendant care, personal emergency response system, nutrition assessments, things like that. So those are the types of care that's in this Medicaid Managed Care Long-Term Care Program. So now let's talk about our state-funded programs, and I'm extremely grateful to the legislature because over the course of my time here and even before, the legislature has been so committed and supportive of the services that we provide. So I wanted to touch on those and just to tell you thank you for all the work and commitment and support that you've provided. Our state-funded programs include the Alzheimer's Disease Initiative, which I'm going to talk to you a little bit about, the Office of Public and Professional Guardians, and I'm sure you've heard a lot about that program as well, the Community Care for the Elderly, and we'll talk a little bit about what that does, and Home Care for the Elderly. A little bit, too, before we talk about the Alzheimer's Disease Initiative, or ADI, is dementia in Florida. The prevalence in Florida, we have second highest prevalence for Alzheimer's disease in the country. We have 580,000, and that number is going to go up significantly because their new numbers come out in March, but we have 500,000 Floridians living with dementia here in our state, and almost a million, approximately 800,000, providing unpaid care, which is usually a family member. By year 2025, that number for people living with Alzheimer's here in Florida is going to shoot up to over 700,000, which makes this one of the most burdensome diseases we will be facing in our time. The governor's five-point action plan came out, and I was there to be part of that and so grateful that we were building the infrastructure within his first 100 days of office. that plan really came to fruition. So we had ticked off all 4 points of the plan. We had one point left, and we were able to realize that in June when we launched the Florida Alzheimer's Center of Excellence, and that is born directly out of our state unit on aging. The governor announced that in June, and I'm incredibly grateful that we have the opportunity to do that. And I'm gonna tell you a little bit about more about that as we go. The Alzheimer's Disease Initiative is a continuum of services, and this is critical to individuals and families affected by dementia. You really can't think of the person living with the disease without thinking of their family and their caregivers. So ADI supports caregiver respite services, support services, the memory disorder clinic that we talked about, and the Brain Bank Network. There are 17 memory disorder clinics, and they'll do diagnostic tests and screening and referrals, really to look at early detection, early diagnosis, and again, help those families with care planning. And the Brain Bank service education and research to ultimately find the most direct path to prevention, treatment, and cure, and that's going to be through research. I can't tell you how much I appreciate the legislature for making this a top priority. We've received record funding amounts throughout the years, and we continue to work with that to be really a leader in the nation. When I say Florida is leading the nation, we certainly are through our funding and our infrastructure and our research. And that brings me to the Florida Alzheimer's Center of Excellence. Again, I told you it was just the last part of the governor's 5-part plan. We're really working with next generation technology and innovation, and this is a first of its kind. You'll hear about other centers of excellence across the country, but this is the only one that the State Unit on Aging, the actual government, is hosting. So we have care navigators who are now working with families. It's an evidence-based, no wrong door strategy, and it really works to enhance the infrastructure available to seniors and their families and their caregivers as they're dealing with this long and arduous disease. The innovative partnerships that we're working on will help to place not only, so we're not only working with these families to help navigate and journey through this disease, but perhaps pair them with a clinical trial that may be happening in their area. Again, a nod to the research that will be paramount in making sure that we put an end to this disease. We also have another pilot program that I'm really proud of in Broward County, and that's the NAN Cares pilot program that you see. We are working with 235 families receiving support. The partnership is between the Area Agency on Aging, the Department of Elder Affairs, and a private partnership with NAN Cares. And again, this is working to reduce the burden of care and increase the emotional well-being, not only of the person living with the disease, but the caregiver themselves. And it's a cost-effective approach. We see 20% less in home and community-based service rates than we ever have. And early data shows possible hospitalization rates are going down by approximately 20% with this cohort. Again, that's the 235 families. So this is an addition to the work that we're doing on the Alzheimer's Disease Initiative. And finally, I just wanted to tell you a little bit of the last part of the infrastructure. When I said infrastructure, I really meant it, because the Florida State Health Improvement Plan is another part of the governor's initiative and his priority. We were one of the only state in the country that had Alzheimer's disease and related dementia as its standalone priority on a state health improvement plan. Now we're one of two. Tennessee followed suit, so I'm excited about that. But what does that mean for us? That means that Florida decided that Alzheimer's disease and related dementia is a public health priority across the state, and it's its own standalone priority. So the work that we're doing along with the Department of Health has been leading the nation in making that public health priority transition into more infrastructure and services. So I'm so pleased to be working with the Department of Health and other sister agencies on the State Health Improvement Plan. And then we wanted to talk briefly about the Office of Public and Professional Guardians. They hold contracts with public guardian offices statewide. And this office under the Department of Elder Affairs is responsible for the registration, which is really licensure, and education of all the professional guardians in the state. This office also researches complaints that may lead to investigations and discipline of guardians, which is critical. And we know that it is, especially now more than ever, how important that education and that research is to ensure that we're doing the very best by the wards that we're serving. I'm proud of the public and professional guardians program because they decided along with the guardian associations that they really wanted to enhance training. So that's what we're doing right now through our rules and regulations, is not only to enhance training and add additional training, but real specific training to help the guardians work better with their wards to ensure that they're safe and protected. And this was something the guardians wanted too. So it's been a really guiding force for us to ensure that we're doing that. Alongside them, we serve all 67 counties, and this will increase oversight of the professional guardians. And right now, we're developing new monitoring tools that will assist us and enhance that monitoring. The community and support services. So we have community care for the elderly, and that's a community-based service to continue living independently. Again, you'll hear that theme about living and aging in the place of our choosing independently for as long as we can. Examples of this for community care for the elderly are adult daycare, chore assistance, counseling, emergency home repairs, legal assistance, shopping assistance. Those are the kinds of things you'll see in our CCE program. Home care for the elderly is close. It's like community care, but a little different in that it provides specific in-home services that will allow seniors to continue aging at home. And mostly it's a monthly subsidy to be used for things like medication, medical supplies, wheelchairs, home health aides, etc. We also have local services that allow seniors to continue living outside of long-term care communities and at home or at a loved one's home. Examples include case management. We talked about congregate meals, home-delivered meals, which are critical, which you'll see Meals on Wheels is the most popular of that, respite and transportation. The Department of Elder Affairs administers all three of these programs with our partnerships with the area agencies on aging. So those are the folks that are direct in community and really are our guiding partners to what the community needs most. So we're getting to my favorite part, which is additional department programs and our highlights. And really, I wanted to focus on seniors helping seniors in our volunteer-driven spaces. So we'll talk first about SHINE. SHINE is the Serving Health Insurance Needs of Elders, and it's our volunteer-based program. It offers free, unbiased counseling on health insurance for seniors. So if y'all have had to navigate that, you know how tough that can be. So these seniors, and there's approximately 200 of these SHINE volunteers, I got to meet with them, and they are fantastic, so well-educated, can help traverse the really difficult process of choosing what's best and fits best for our families and what we're eligible for insurance. They really help our seniors ensure they're opting into the best suited coverage. And many of these volunteers, like I said, are retired seniors themselves, so they really know what other seniors need. I love this program, and we're continuing to enhance it with more volunteers as we speak. I told you a little bit about Florida Elder Helpline, and you'll see in 2022, we had almost 65,000 calls that we took. These folks do such a great job. The call center is housed in the department. It's really right down the hall. So one of the first things I did when I became secretary is sat in on a whole bunch of those calls. And it really was a one-stop shop. It could be anything about housing needs to services that they're eligible for, and then to critical issues that were much more intense and needed immediate service. So I really appreciate what our call center does, and we work with our area agencies on aging who also have their elder helplines too. We offer that in other languages as well, so I got to hear a couple of calls in Spanish as well, and I love what the call center does. Like I said, it's a one-stop shop, and I'm hoping that it helps make our aging network a little bit more easy to navigate. One of my favorite things that I got to work on this year was Hope Florida. We called ours a pathway to purpose. This is the First Ladies Initiative, and it was modeled after the Department of Children and Families. Theirs was a pathway to prosperity, but when the First Lady approached us, I really thought seniors were a little bit different. We wanted to look at purpose, purposeful about, do we need to offer help as seniors, or do we need help ourselves? So we got to put our pathway to purpose purpose in full. We really had to launch it fully and completely really quickly, because as we were building these Hope Navigators and Hope Heroes is what we decided to call our volunteers, Hurricane Ian hit. So it was really about a week before we were pulling all of our volunteers together, training them, doing background checks on them, and then Hurricane Ian hit. We expedited that process significantly and deployed over 60 of those volunteers. We got 240 of them and an all-call right after that talking about the First Lady's initiative. So they did telephone reassurance for folks that were impacted by the hurricane, and some were deployed directly into the most impacted areas. And I got to work alongside of them. And here you see them on your screen. They're absolutely amazing. A lot of them were seniors, and some of them were not. But it was a one-to-one helping experience, and I just can't say enough about the work that they did. Right now we're working on our companionship model with the long-term care ombudsman. So as the ombudsman go in to look at maybe the safety and welfare of people living in long-term care communities, my hope and vision is that a Hope Hero will go in and sit down with that resident and just spend time with them. That will be to mitigate social isolation, just the impacts of loneliness and isolation that we know a lot of our seniors feel. So I'm so proud of the work the Hope Heroes have done this year. And then you'll, just to culminate that, you're going to see the 30th anniversary of the department. So I got to come in and immediately celebrate 30 years of service from the Department of Elder Affairs. We traveled the whole state. I started by telling you that. We wanted to identify gaps in service. Some of those were looking to change and improve rate structure and service matrix. So we sat down with providers and I said, look, guys, this is an unfiltered opportunity to sit down with the department. And some of them had said, we've never seen a secretary or leadership here in our space before. So they really did tell me. So not only did I get to hear from the providers some of their biggest concerns, but we also got to hear direct from the seniors too. So when I visited the spaces, I learned more from them than they'll ever learn from me. So it was really important to spend this year evaluating and then use this year, 2023, to implement. So we put together an internal task force called the Florida Affecting Change Today for Seniors. We meet once a week to look at some of the biggest issues that we face out in the community that our area agencies on aging are looking at, that our direct service providers, and folks, post-pandemic economy, you have staffing issues, you have supply chain issues, a lot of things that we know every industry is facing, but we want to make sure that we're purposefully and intentionally tackling this every week, listening to their voices. So in 2023, I'll be looking to implement some of the things that we know that worked really well in planning service areas and some of the spaces that we need to close the gap. I'm truly proud of all of the work that the FACTS team has done and our entire team who tirelessly was out there in the field where I was scribbling down notes and texting them back saying these are really important things, let's not forget what we're doing, and making sure the team was on it and responding immediately to some of the issues we faced. I'm really excited about our next year because, like I said, it's the year of implementation, and I'm proud to be serving as your Secretary of Elder Affairs, especially during this pivotal time. It's not easy, but I feel called to do it, and like I said, when I'm out there in the field, I really, truly believe the seniors of Florida have so much to give. This is such a cherished space. One that I'm honored and privileged to do every day with our team. So I just thank you for the time to share a little bit about what we do and the people that we do it for, and I'm willing to take any and all questions at this time. Thank you, Chair Koster, Vice Chair Maney, Ranking Member Robinson, and all of the committee for hearing me today.
Thank you, Secretary Brannon, for all of the information and everything that you're doing. Members, any questions for Secretary Brannon? Rep. Williams, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this presentation. I really appreciate it, and a lot of information was given. And can we go back to slide 17, please? You spoke very briefly on unpaid caregivers on this slide. Are we doing anything about it, or how can we get additional information to these caregivers that there is help out there to assist them in any way, or is there something that you already have in the making?
Madam Chair?
You're recognized.
Thank you. That's such a great question, and it's a really important one. So the unpaid caregivers are traditionally family members or a spouse or a loved one. So the Florida Alzheimer's Center of Excellence is working directly with those caregivers. So you have the NAN Cares Project, the Florida Alzheimer's Center of Excellence, we call FACE, really working specifically with caregivers to help educate them and to put together a comprehensive care plan for them and their families so they are able to navigate through what's going to be a very difficult and long process. Beyond that, the area agencies on aging have so much resource and support at their disposal through our Alzheimer's Disease Initiative. So thanks to the legislature and all the work and support we've done, there are so many support services for caregivers through that traditional funding source as well. So the pilot programs plus the traditional funding source. But I don't ever think it's enough, so I think there's more we can do there too. And I'm going to continue to push that through our Center of Excellence. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Secretary. Ranking Member Robinson, you're recognized.
Thank you. And thank you. And what you did coming in as Secretary has been really great. I remember you did come down to my district and visited in Pembroke Pines, and I had opportunity to walk some of the facilities with you. So I think that was amazing, and I do know that it's very beneficial. My question has to do with the Medicaid Managed Care and long-term care program. And I kind of wanted to know, is there a cap of the total enrollment in that statewide program?
Madam Chair?
You're recognized.
That's an excellent question. Thank you for asking it. I don't believe that there's a cap. The only cap would be through the funding sources, but as far as I understand, we can enroll as many people as are eligible. We can continue to enroll them until we get
the money runs up.
Yeah, until the money runs up.
Okay, and I have several questions I want to ask you, but I'm going to actually schedule a meeting with you.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Great. Representative Woodson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I be recognized for two questions, please?
You may. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Madam Secretary, for your presentation. I really appreciate the information that you are giving us in order to address the needs of our seniors. I've always mentioned our committee before my dad passed, and he always told me, when you go to Tallahassee, make sure you advocate for our seniors. So that's extremely important to me. And one of the things that I always focus on is the wait list for our seniors. My first question has to do with those individuals who are on the wait list under Category 4. Do they ever get to be off the wait list since they are at Category 4 to move up to the 1? Or do they have to wait until their situation gets worse before they can get access to services?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. Talking about wait lists, we talk more of it being an intake process because you're talking about people. We have to focus on the most critical need people first, and then we go down through that. So it depends on what the assessment of the person is and what the need is. And then you'll see that folks rotate off of it once they've been provided the care that they need. So it really depends, again, on where they are in their journey, how they've been assessed, whether or not you said a level 4, which is a critical need. There's level 5 is the highest, so level 4 is the second highest to 5. So you'll see those folks addressed first. So the answer is difficult because I think they're going to be able to get the care that they need based on the critical nature of their needs first. But we're not going to be able to serve every single person we can at the minute that they need the service. And that's something that I want to continue working on. So I want to be transparent to tell you that not everybody on that wait list is getting hit right there and getting the resource and the services and the support that they need right there at critical care. But we will address the folks that have critical care first. So it's going to be the 4s and the 5s and even 3, 4s, and 5s first. I don't know if that's answering your question or not.
Follow up.
Yes,
that.
You're right.
I believe category 1 is the one with the crisis, the one that get addressed first as opposed to 4. That's what I believe. But you can research that.
Okay.
You can. It's okay. You can research that.
Thank you.
And we'll talk after that. My second question has to do with how much funding do you think it would take to zero off the wait list in order for everyone to have access? Because I'm telling you, I'm getting inundated with calls from seniors in my district who's been on the wait list and they are not getting access to services. And I know it's an issue, but do you know how much it would cost to zero off the wait list?
Madam Chair.
You're recognized.
So what I can tell you is that the legislature has provided historic amounts of funding, and each year we serve more folks. As far as getting everybody on the wait list, I think that that's something that we want to continue to tackle with expanded services. I can't tell you how much. If I could give you a figure, it would, I think it would be above and beyond what our capability levels are because of the need being as great as it is. But I can tell you that with the level of service we're providing, some of the folks, we need to educate them more on how they get the assessments, what they're eligible to receive, where they fall out on the wait list, and then provide them with care. So like I said, each of these services are expanded each and every day to take care of more seniors all the time. But I agree with you, it's not going to be enough for right now. So for the constituents that you're facing and listening to every day who are sharing their anxiety and their concern and stress about that, I'd love for you to be able to call our offices, because I'd like to make sure, one, that they've got the assessment, that they're screened appropriately. Some of that has to do with why they're not being processed through quickly and accurately, and then make sure we're doing everything we can to get them through that process as quickly as possible. But I'd love to be able to help you with that and your constituents, because I understand those questions and they're stressful.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I would like to schedule a meeting with you I know it's going to be possible. So let's schedule a meeting so we can talk about that.
Absolutely. Okay? Be my pleasure. Thank you so much, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Michael, you're recognized for a question.
I want to thank you for your presentation. It's very thorough, and we need this. Madam Chair, if I may ask two questions.
You may.
Thank you. One of my questions is your ratio of care that's needed compared to the ombudsman's. I do see you have 200 that are certified. What is that ratio compared to the residents that need it?
Madam Chair.
You're recognized.
That's a great question. There are 4,000 long-term care communities in the state of Florida, so we have a lot of people to serve. And if you imagine, some of them are small, some of them are quite large, but 200 ombudsmen isn't near enough volunteer base to be doing that work. One of the things I started immediately when I became secretary was thinking about this ombudsman program and making sure that we could enhance that to meet the need. The volunteer base was at 600 or 700, but then we went through COVID, and that entire program really laid dormant for far too long because they weren't allowed into the communities for a while. So really building that back up is going to be critical. I think 600 or 700 with a nice base of staff is a good ratio for us. Bless you. But I don't think it will be near enough. I'll never think it'll be near enough to serve everybody in the time that we want to, but I do think it gives them the opportunity to visit each of the long-term care communities approximately 4 to 6 times a year and really get in there and speak with the residents. On top of that, they'll get to respond to specific complaints as well. So if you call the ombudsman and you had a specific complaint, they could also respond to that in kind, and they have been able to do that. Even with 200, we're stretched a little thin. But I appreciate the question.
My second question is, what is your average retention of your ombudsman?
Madam Chair.
You're recognized.
Thank you for the question. They don't leave. They love the work. And once you get in there and you are empowered to help others that are more vulnerable than you, something happens. Something changes you. So I can tell you my stepdad is in the ombudsman program. He's 78 years old, and he will not leave. There will be no way I could extract him from that program. My whole family is recruited in some way, shape, or form in everything I do, but he really fell in love with being there long-term, taking care of it, and also gave him a sense of purpose. My mom said, we need to get him out of the house doing something. It gave him a real sense of purpose to be out there taking care of people, and it changed him. It changes all of them. So we don't lose ombudsmen. The only way that we lose them because they're seniors is maybe they're not physically able to do it anymore, and they do have to really officially retire in all capacities and kind of rest. But that's really the only way that we end up losing them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Pulsencio, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. How many seniors are currently in the wait list for the long-term care program?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have the figures right here in front of me for how many seniors are in the long-term care wait list. We look at Alzheimer's disease and the Alzheimer's Disease Initiative wait list and things like that. But I could get you those figures if you would like me to stop by your office. I'll make sure that we put the list together and show you what all of the wait lists look like and how much it is for each.
Thank you. I would appreciate that.
My pleasure. Thank you for the question.
Representative Harris, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Secretary. I was just wondering, it's more of like a clarification for me, the difference between the role of HOPE Florida and the role of the Aging and Disability Resource Centers, like the difference between them.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great question. So I get confused by that one, the ADRCs. They really are the Area Agencies on Aging. It's just another name for them. So they're partners with the Department of Elder Affairs, and those are the 11 agencies that really put the contracts together with lead agencies and providers in community, because each community is a little different. We know, because we represent all different communities here, what the needs are and what the population is. The HOPE Florida Initiative is really an overlay over all of what we do. So those HOPE heroes can be coming from anywhere. It's a volunteer-driven program. When the First Lady approached us, we knew what we did best was volunteerism. So we wanted to garner as many volunteers as we could, and we also knew that isolation and loneliness and companionship was a big issue facing our seniors. So we started to really look at that and hone in on that. So HOPE, I'm proud to say all of our Area Agencies on Aging adopted the HOPE Hero volunteerism opportunity. So they each have HOPE Heroes in their own areas as well, and that helps us to deploy them. Does that help answer the question?
Thank you.
Vice Chair Maney, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't really have a question. I have a request. If somebody from the agency would come talk to me about the intersection of Baker Act, Alzheimer's, dementia, adults, I would love to get your insight on that and how we can address that issue, as well as the intersection of your agency with other departments like Department of Veterans Affairs and the Clerks Corporation dealing with guardianships.
Right. Madam Chair,
you're recognized.
I just want somebody to come see me.
Well, it's going to be me, because you're speaking directly into my heart right now. I spent almost 10 years with the Alzheimer's Association, and we addressed Baker Act issues quite a bit. So that intersection that you're talking about is a space that is indelible in my heart right now. So I'd love to come talk to you about that.
Thank you.
Representative Lopez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary, I wanted to know if you had a list, if it's available, the long-term care facilities that are within each of our districts and then the waiting lists within those districts. That would be very helpful, at least in my area. I represent the urban core area of Miami-Dade, and I have a lot of the elderly that came many, many years ago from Cuba who have now between 70 and 101, and I've knocked on most of those doors and have seen some incredible stories that I would love to talk with you about as well. But just getting that information will be very helpful for me. Thank you.
Madam Chair. I would love to. I just spoke with Senator Garcia, and we were having this conversation exactly. So I'm pulling the data for her and be happy to share it with you as well and stop by and visit with you. And retrieve my glasses.
Seeing no additional questions, thank you so much, Secretary Branham, for being with us this morning and sharing all of this important information. And for being available to take all of these follow-up meetings that have been requested.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and to the House staff, too. Thank you so much for helping us put this all together. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, members, next we have Rose Salinas, the Deputy Director of Budget Planning and Administration of the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. Welcome, Ms. Salinas, you're recognized.
Good afternoon, Chair Koster, Vice Chair Maney, Ranking Member Robinson, and members of the committee. My name is Rose Salinas. I'm the Deputy Director of Budget and Planning for the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to come and speak with you to give an overview of our agency today. I'd also like to thank Governor Ron DeSantis and the legislature for your incredible support for individuals with developmental disabilities within our state. Our agency's mission, we support persons with developmental disabilities in living, learning, and working with their communities. As many of you know, the Agency for Persons with Disabilities serves more than 61,620 people annually as of November 1st, 2022. APD serves individuals with one or more of the following developmental disabilities, including severe forms of autism, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, intellectual disabilities, Phelan-McDermott syndrome, Prader-Willi syndrome, and spina bifida. Please note that services to individuals under the age of 21 are limited due to the extensive services covered for eligible children through AHCA's Florida Medicaid program. Our agency has four priorities, main priorities. The first, we're focused on working to meet and exceed these every day. Our first is service availability. We want to improve access to community-based services and provide opportunity treatment and residential options. Our second priority is employment. We strive to increase the number of individuals with developmental disabilities in the workplace. Accountability is another big priority with us. We want to improve, make sure that we're serving our clients to the best of our abilities and that the services we provide benefit our clients. And then resource management. We try to be good stewards of our agency and state resources. We manage our agency's budget to stay within fiscal appropriation. The 22-23 General Appropriations Act for APD included some of the following highlights. We were thankful to receive $403 million in funds to go toward increases in provider rates for direct service professionals. Those went into effect July 1st of this year. We received $59.6 million in additional recurring funds to provide waiver services to APD clients. $14.2 million in recurring funds for waiver rate increases for behavioral services. We also received $8.5 million to procure a contract for a statewide dental service program for individuals with DD. And the legislature appropriated $1.5 million for the agency to begin a study to design and build a new forensic facility to be built on the agency's existing campus in Jackson County. We also received $1 million in recurring funds to assist individuals with developmental disabilities with employment and internships who are on the waiting list. As you can see from our 22-23 appropriation pie chart, our overall budget for 22-23 totaled $2.15 billion, $1.9 billion of that dedicated to our clients on the iBudget Florida waiver. $144.6 million was designated to operate our 24/7 civil and forensic facilities. $40 million is designated to operate our program management and compliance divisions, and we overall have a 4% annual budget for administrative cost. Let's talk a little bit about how our agency is structured. Our primary programmatic divisions include the Division of Operations and the Division of Programs. The Division of Operations includes the Bureau of Provider Supports and the Bureau of Consumer Supports, and our Division of Programs includes our CDC Consumer Directed Care Plus program, which we'll discuss in just a few minutes, our facilities, and maintains our compliance. Let's look at our Division of Operations. Provides oversight to operational oversight and policy direction for initiatives supporting both consumers and providers. We have it divided into two subgroups. The Bureau of Provider Supports is responsible for provider enrollment, technical assistance, terminations, and then incident management and abuse, neglect and exploitation follow-up, and licensing and monitoring activities. They also include the Bureau of Consumer Supports is responsible for managing the waiver eligibility, enrollment, and waiting list, waiver service approval, and significant additional needs, also known as SANs, and then specialty programs, including supported living, employment, and our individual and family supports. iBudget Florida is the name of the agency's home and community-based services waiver. iBudget Florida gives APD customers flexibility to choose medically necessary services that meet the health and safety needs. The iBudget waiver is a more effective way to manage the home and community-based services waiver. Our agency works together with external waiver support coordinators and providers to meet the needs of Floridians with developmental disabilities. This slide shows individuals on our home and community-based services waiver by disability. We currently serve a total of 35,241 individuals on our waiver. As you can see, the largest disability group is individuals with intellectual disabilities with an IQ under 70, which accounts for 72% of our total waiver enrollment. Within these clients, we have our top five living settings. Almost all of our clients live in one of the five living settings outlined on this table, with close to 20,000 individuals living in the family home. On our waiting list, is broken down by priority and percentage, and this is data as of November 1st, 2022. There are 22,435 clients that are on our waiting list for the iBudget Florida waiver. Our eligible individuals seeking services from the waiver are enrolled on a priority waiting list defined in statute. Clients who are in crisis situations and require urgent waiver assistance from APD are prioritized for immediate enrollment into the waiver. Additionally, children in the child welfare system are processed for immediate waiver enrollment at the time of adoption, reunification, permanency, or turning 18 while in foster care. Although our waiting list appears long, nearly half of the clients on our waiting list are not in immediate need of waiver services because they receive services through Medicaid state plan for individuals under 21 and may also be receiving services through non-waiver funding. The iBudget waiver offers 26 services broken up into the following eight service categories. There are family skills development, supplies and equipment, personal supports, residential services, support coordination, therapeutic supports and wellness, transportation, and dental services. In the month of October, the total iBudget Florida waiver expenditures equaled $132,641,000. Residential rehabilitation and personal supports accounted for over half of all these expenditures. There are currently 22,435 individuals on the waiting list for the iBudget Florida waiver. For fiscal year 21-22, APD was able to use the $95.7 million in funding to enroll 1,552 individuals from the waiting list onto the waiver, and we're continuing to roll additional clients with the remaining available funds. Over the past 4 years, ABD has enrolled more than 4,000 individuals onto the waiver from the waiting list. Our Division of Programs, we have our Consumer Directed Care Plus program, which is known as CDC Plus. CDC Plus is a long-term care alternative to the Florida Medicaid Home and Community-Based Services waiver. This program provides individuals with an opportunity to improve the quality of their lives by empowering them to make their own choices about supports and services that meet their own long-term care goals and the need to reach them. The Division of Programs also provides policy, procedure, training, and technical assistance to CDC Plus customers, and this is the largest self-directed program in the nation. Division of Programs also oversees our state facilities. We have two long-term care civil developmental disability centers and one forensic developmental disability center. We'll speak a little bit more about that in just a moment. And we also, the Division of Programs works with program development, compliance, and quality management. We work with ACA on the preparation of submission of waivers to CMS. We work with federal compliance and provider trainings. In talking about our facilities, we have a one for forensic, post-forensic, and facility in two locations. At Chattahoochee, we are co-located with Florida State Hospital. We have the Developmental Disabilities Dependent Program, known as DDP. It's funded for 130 beds. The maximum capacity is 146. This is for defendants with developmental disabilities who are deemed incompetent to participate in their own defense or stand trial. The primary goal of DDP is to restore residents to competency. Our Pathways Center, which is also a secure center located in Marianna on our Sunland campus, is for individuals court-ordered for secure placement under Florida Statute 39311, whose competency cannot be restored, but they continue to require secure placement. These programs provide individuals with optimal levels of adaptive behaviors in the least restrictive environment while preparing residents to transition to less restrictive and non-secure placements. Currently, the agency is conducting the study that was funded this year to build a new forensic facility to house both DDP and Pathways on the agency's existing campus at Sunland Marianna in Jackson County. APD serves more than 500 people at our three developmental disability centers in Gainesville, Marianna, and Chattahoochee. As the agency continues to move to community-based model, the number of individuals and intermediate care facilities has declined over the last 20 years. Many of the individuals in our two civil centers located at Sunland and Marianna and Taquachalli and Gainesville have lived their entire lives at the facility, and for them, it is their only home.
Thank you, Ms. Salinas, for your presentation, for being with us today. Members, any questions? Representative Harris, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for this really informative presentation. I had a question about the wait list. You had mentioned that there were still quite a few people on the wait list. I was wondering if we had a time frame for how long it takes someone to move through the wait list. Thank you.
You're recognized.
Thank you. That's an excellent question. I guess it depends on where they come in, what category they are. We have individuals, of course, under 21 who are on the wait list who really are not in any particular need of services. At any given time, at any level of the wait list, if someone goes into a crisis situation where they require immediate placement and then they move immediately from whatever category they're in to our top category, and they're brought onto the waiver out through that.
Representative Woodson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for your presentation. Can we go back to slide 15, please? Okay. All right. Thank you. I noticed for the year 2021, you have served 500 for a cost of $30.2 million. And it has jumped to 2021, where you have served three times what you did in 2021 and off the wait list, right? So what is your projection? Because what is your projection for 22, 23 versus the money that you have right now?
You're recognized.
Thank you. That's a very good question. I can give you some more detailed data. We'll have to come back to you. But we anticipate, we normally through crisis, and we enroll approximately 1,000 to 1,200 people each year. We did receive the $59.6 million in funding, which we anticipate will allow us to bring more than the projected crisis amount. But I will have to get that data and get back with the committee.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Tremont, you're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have about 1,000 questions. I would like to schedule a meeting, and thank you for that question that was just asked, because I had the similar question. I'd like that information as well regarding the wait list. But I'd like to schedule a meeting, please.
You're recognized.
Thank you. Certainly, we would love to meet with you and provide that information to the committee. Yes.
Yeah, and if you'll provide that to us, I can disseminate to the committee.
Thank you.
Members, any other questions? Representative Williams, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we go back to slide 5? You spoke about $4.3 million additional funding. Does that have anything to do with the direct care workers? Are raises included in that?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Yes, the $403 million funding we received this past session was in response to bringing the direct service professionals to $15 per hour minimum.
Madam Chair, follow up.
You're recognized.
You also spoke about $6.7 million for infrastructure fixed capital. Is that enough funding?
You're recognized.
Thank you. That's a great question. We do have, like I said, we have three facilities, and all of our facilities, especially the one at Sunland and Mariana and Takachali, are considerably older facilities, 70-plus years old. The one in Sunland, Mariana, was a former military barracks. We certainly have constant FCO needs, so we work with, you know, what we are appropriated, and we will continue as we are able to improve things to ask for funding each year.
One last question.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you talk about the community-based services compared to the services of the institution, the cost is quite different. Are you recommending any additional changes to that?
You're recognized.
I may need a little bit more clarification. There is a considerable difference in cost and care. The average cost of a person on the waiver is around $61,000, $62,000. The average cost of institutional care is close to $200,000 at this time. I'm not sure what you're asking, if I could get a little more clarification.
You're recognized.
Yeah, comparing the two, are we encouraging more of the community-based services versus institutionalized?
You're recognized.
Okay, thank you. I apologize for misunderstanding. Yes, we certainly, our goal is to provide care to our clients in the least restrictive environment possible. We like, you know, we would prefer to keep people in their family homes. As you could see, almost 20,000 of our clients are in their family homes and are able to receive services that there. So certainly, as much as possible, we would like to keep them in the least restrictive environment.
Okay, seeing no additional questions, thank you so much for being here and for sharing your time with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Okay, members, that concludes our agenda for today. Again, next week, we will hear from the remaining agencies under our jurisdiction. I look forward to working with all of you in the weeks to come. If you need anything, please don't hesitate to reach out. And Representative Tremont moves. We rise without objection. The meeting is adjourned.